Welcome to This Week in the Warner Archive Collection, where we discuss our newest releases. I'm George Feltenstein, and I'm proud to be joined by my colleagues, Matt Patterson and D.W. Ferranti. We have a dozen new offerings to the Warner Archive Collection, as well as one returning in a new format. So let's get the discussion underway and celebrate the arrival of not one, but two favorite films on Blu-ray disc, lovingly remastered by Warner Brothers Motion Picture Imaging for your Blu-ray pleasure. They are master filmmaker Sam Peckinpah's The Ballad of Cable Hogue from 1970 and The Gumball Rally, a fan favorite cult film from 1976, both new to Blu-ray, just for you to own from the Warner Archive Collection. Then we have all kinds of TV on DVD. We have an old series and a recent series. The classic series is Hondo, the complete series. This is a series that went on the air in 1967, based on the movie that John Wayne starred in at Warner Brothers in the 1950s. And this was Ralph Trager, who was the star of this series. It was on ABC. It didn't last very long, but it didn't fade from the memories of those who enjoyed it. And now the complete series is on DVD for the first time. We also have a more contemporary series that has a familial relationship to another series that we've released on Warner Archive. And we just released the first season not too long ago. Of course, we're talking about Newsreaders, the complete second season from 2014 and 15. Then we're going to talk briefly about some musicals that were out of print or in collections that are now all available as single titles: Romance on the High Seas, It's a Great Feeling, My Dream is Yours, Summerstock, Young Man with a Horn, which isn't a musical, but it's a drama with music, and great music at that. And then Annie Get Your Gun, one of the great Irving Berlin classics of all time, Les Girls, and last but not least, one of our gorgeous Blu-rays that we just released earlier this year, Bells Are Ringing, is back in print on DVD. Last but not least, we're speaking of back in print, we have not one, but two amazing films directed by the indescribably amazing John Waters: Pink Flamingos from 1972, and the lesser seen but deservedly lauded by fans, Desperate Living from 1977. We also have some letters that consumers have sent us, so let's get the show on the road and start the discussion with our new Blu-ray 2017 gorgeous remaster of The Ballad of Cable Hogue, starring Jason Robards and Stella Stevens under the able direction of Mr. Sam Peckinpah.
It's interesting to view this film as sort of an unintentional trilogy of Peckinpah's, because he has three very famous films, and this is the third of them, that all take place in the early 20th century West. And if you think about, like, Ride the High Country, it takes that setting and applies it to, like, a traditional Western. And then Wild Bunch takes that setting and applies it to, like, a deconstructionist or spaghetti Western. And then this is almost a neo-realist Western.
I like
De Sica Goes West.
There's sort of a sub-Western genre of old men at the end of an era. Because Westerns, just part of their conceit is that we all know that this is a time that will pass, because these are about people coming into the new land and they're going to settle it.
One of the things to just put everything in context is there were several films that he made in between Ride the High Country and The Wild Bunch. We're just talking about films in our library.
Right.
But the growth of Peckinpah as a filmmaker kind of came to a high point, an apex, if you will, with The Wild Bunch, which is one of the greatest Westerns probably of all time, and certainly one of the most violent and one of the most revisionist. It changed Western filmmaking forever, and certain other films that came after could never have been made had not been for Sam Peckinpah. But The Ballad of Cable Hogue was a departure from The Wild Bunch. It was decidedly light.
It's much more of a comedy.
Yes.
It is also much more of a gentle character study. I mean, Jason Robards, Cable Hogue, is a crusty curmudgeon, and he's on a path of vengeance, but the film is about essentially an entrepreneurial spirit with an underpinning.
And it's almost like there's a spiritual rebirth at the beginning of this film.
We get David Warner, who very often plays heavies. He's not the heavy in this, and is super charming.
He's the Han Solo.
It's so weird to see him be a good guy.
Yes.
But good in quotation marks.
A good rogue.
A good rogue.
Yeah, he's a rogue.
Yeah. He's Han Solo. And then Stella Stevens is maybe her best performance in a career that is very overlooked these days. And she's super in this.
I mean, her career actually started in the late 50s and just kept going and going. And throughout the 60s, I mean, it was only 2 years before she was playing a nun in Where Angels Go, Trouble Follows. She had then moved into television movies in the 70s, as well as some other, some B-pictures and whatnot. But her career just blossomed over a period of a long time. So, and there's even a special piece on the disc just about her.
And in a nutshell, the story of Cable Hogue, his ballad, if you will. He's done wrong. He's left to die in the wilderness. He discovers a watering hole. He knows if he builds this watering hole, sooner or later the people that did him wrong will come to him because it's the only water in 40 miles. So he sets about creating a truck stop, if you will.
An oasis that is a honey trap.
The film also features a number of great Western actors that Peckinpah would very often turn to, as almost everybody else in the business did, including Slim Pickens, Strother Martin, and L.Q. Jones.
Unlike The Wild Bunch, this film was not a box office success when it opened. However, years have been very kind to it, and with Peckinpah's reputation having grown significantly, especially in the last 25 years or so, this film has become kind of quintessential viewing, and if you look at it now, you say, well, why wasn't this a hit? Because it's a really, really great film, and I really want to shout out to the photography. The cinematography in this movie is just luscious.
And of course, the Blu-ray format is the best way to see it.
With new technologies coming along, you have a chance to actually make films look better and expose warts, which is what makes it a lot harder when you're working in high def and you're working to achieve cleanliness, and you've got a main title sequence several minutes into the movie that is filled with all sorts of opticals.
Oh, yeah.
And this was a challenge for the wizards of ours. The colorist at MPI, Warner Brothers Motion Picture Imaging, who worked on this film, was overwhelmed by the job that was facing her. But what we did was we brought in an original dye transfer Technicolor reference print so she could know exactly what the colors should look like. And this is the best Cable Hogue has ever looked, probably since the day it opened. Maybe even better.
The color holds up in such an incredible way. And of course, the location photography does not hurt. You know, when you have such a great location with such great natural light and incredible photography like this, again, this is what, you know, HD was made for.
Exactly. I was going to say this is what Blu-ray was built for. So we're thinking along the same lines. Now, our next film is decidedly different.
Yes. But talk about standing up.
This is one of the films that has been most requested for Blu-ray by many, many people who send us letters and post on our social media sites. And everybody wanted The Gumball Rally from 1970. Now, folks, just to be clear about this, this did precede Cannonball Run, but there were some other films in the B genre world that happened around the same time.
And they were all inspired by the real-life Cannonball Rally, which had a very brief existence but inspired many B movie makers and A movie makers to venture into the illegal cross-country road race genre. But the Gumball Rally was really the one that, like, set the tone and created a genre.
And filmically, when we have The Great Race, another Blu-ray, and, like, you know, wacky races like this, the unofficial cross-country race plot had been used before.
Wacky Races was official, Matthew.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That was, of course, based off of a real race as
well. Yes, and a regular sporting event.
But what this film accomplishes is by taking the anarchic nature of, you know, setting yourself free on the open road and all of the different cars and like, because the cars
are
the stars.
Right.
And the star of this movie is actually Michael Sarrazin, who was popular in the 70s for several films, most notably The Reincarnation of Peter Proud, and he also co-starred with Barbara Streisand in For Pete's Sake. But I think the film he's best remembered for is The Gumball Rally.
I think it has to be. Yeah. He's terrific, but he's very sort of this blend of 70s action star in this, in that it's a blend of irony and sincerity. What's really, I think, great about the Gumball Rally is it is literally the drivers are from all walks of life. So you get a nice little ensemble of different types of people, different classes of people, and they're only doing it for honor.
And it's not an all-star cast. This is really good character actors filling their roles and creating hilarity.
And one character actor in particular really came to the nation's notice playing the Italian race car driver. And I'm, of course, talking about the great Raul Julia, who pretty much steals every scene he's in.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Gary Busey.
Gary Busey's also excellent in this.
And this is Gary Busey before the Buddy Holly story, before Big Wednesday, and before his Amazon commercials.
Yes.
And very, very young Gary Busey.
And this, too, looks like, I mean, non-ironically, I saw this film in a drive-in.
So did I.
Oh, that's funny.
My parents took me to the Elmsford Drive-In Theater, and this was the second film on a double bill.
And watching it, I'm just like, that's the Gumball Rally I saw.
I, of course, probably saw this at a friend's house on HBO.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was a staple on HBO for a very long time, and of course, it lived on in video cassette, then there was DVD, but now it is blue, waiting for you in a brand new master, and it looks gorgeous, and you can add it to your collection from the Warner Archive collection. So take home the Gumball Rally today. Now we're going to shift gears a little bit and keep the emphasis on action as we take you back to 1967 in the ABC television network, where Hondo, the John Wayne movie, was adapted into a television series. And in fact, John Wayne's production company, Bat Jack Productions, was integral in the turning of this movie into a television series. And one of the most notable things about the series is that there's a very, very special guest star in early episodes who had a little bit of a connection with MGM where this series was made. That is, of course, Robert Taylor.
That's right. I thought you were going to say Sam the Dog.
Well, Sam the Dog has his own place in cinema history, but Robert Taylor was in the twilight of his years at MGM and in Hollywood. In fact, he would pass away from cancer at a very untimely early age, but he was one of the first celebrities to go public with lung cancer and to, you know, call attention to the fact that he was suffering from it, because this is just about the time people were realizing that cigarettes were not good for you. In the meantime, I digress. Robert Taylor is wonderful in his appearances in this series, and the star playing Hondo, the role that John Wayne had created a decade plus before, is Ralph Trager.
It's a very interesting premise behind this show. Essentially, Hondo is a man who has lived in many different worlds. He's lived with the Apache. He's an ex-Confederate soldier. He's a good man, but he has the ability to see many sides to the conflicts that were going on in the West. And he's essentially tasked with freelancing, keeping the peace. And that means keeping the peace between the settlers, between the Indians, between the Confederates and the ex-Confederates and the Union, keeping the peace.
It's a pretty good structural setup, because it's almost like he's the traveling angel.
With a gun and a really cool dog.
I'm really surprised this series didn't have a longer run. I think it was where it was placed on the schedule. And if it had been on another network at another night, it would have probably run a lot longer, because these shows are good.
It's a single season show. It's not even a
half season
show. That which are rarely syndicated, but Hondo got syndicated, and when it did, it had a new life as a hit syndicated show, and it's only half a season long, and that's how good it is.
Well, and you could take an hour show like this and run it on weekends when people tend to enjoy their westerns, and they still do, but now you can watch this every day of the week if you pick up Hondo the complete series. There are 17 episodes spread across the DVDs, and you're sure to want to own this if you're a classic TV western collector or both. Our next television series we are honored to bring you the second season of, after we had the honor of bringing you the first. It is from the same talented, insane, brilliant geniuses that brought you Children's Hospital. This is Newsreaders, which was also seen on Adult Swim, as Children's Hospital was.
Well, there's a bit of a change between season one and season two.
What is it?
Our Newsreader host for the Children's Hospital segments and season one of Newsreader moved on to other passages, so they had to bring in a new talent. A new newsreader to fill some very large shoes. But thankfully, they got Alan Tudyk. So now we have Regan Biscayne, who's a different character.
Yes.
But equally hysterical.
We talked about a lot of Westerns and how Westerns would be ubiquitous. I would say newsreaders are even more ubiquitous on TV today. And that's what's so special about this, because their inane chatter is totally logical.
I would say they even get a little bit more extreme and out there with some of the segments on this. And they have a lot of returning segment hosts, new segment hosts. But we have a great deal of Skip Remming, thank goodness, played by the great Ray Wise.
He's so good.
A ton of pretty off-the-hook guests, including the Hoff. David Hasselhoff.
And everybody kind of comes in and almost tries to top the people right before it. It just, and then it deconstructs itself and questions the very value of news shows.
Well, I think that brings up a very good point, because, you know, so much of the product that we bring to market at the Warner Archive Collection is from the past and nostalgia. It evokes a different time and makes people yearn for the past. And as someone who watches the news quite often, at the present time, I yearn for the nostalgia of 2014 and 15.
When fake news was fun news.
That's right, because fake news was things like newsreaders and not... Anyway, moving right along, we urge you to buy Newsreaders. It's on one nice little DVD, all the episodes. It's a lot of fun, and it'll make you hearken back and yearn for the days of 2014 and 15. Now, we want to quickly mention the musicals that are now available as single DVDs from the Warner Archive Collection, many of them with Doris Day, Romance in the High Seas, It's a Great Feeling, and My Dream is Yours, her first three films here at Warner Brothers, but not her last. And we also have Summer Stock from 1950, the last film Judy Garland made at MGM, co-starring Gene Kelly. Great film. Then we have also from 1950, not a musical, but a film with music playing a major part, the brilliant Kirk Douglas, in a story that parallels the life of Bix Beiderbecke. This is Young Man with a Horn, directed by Michael Curtiz, co-starring Lauren Bacall, and of course Doris Day as the woman who longs for him in the corner while she sings. And boy, does she sing some great songs.
An interesting duality there between those two roles.
Oh, yeah.
That's what makes this one stand out.
But this is a Warner Brothers film in every sense of the word. And special props to Ray Heindorf in the music department for rear-kicking soundtrack, shall we say. Also from 1950, quite a year for film, we have none other than Betty Hutton starring in Annie Get Your Gun. This is from 1950. Co-stars Howard Keel in his American film debut. He had been in a British film before this.
Oh, really?
With his big baritone. The film was called The Small Voice. Oh. But MGM signed him and brought him over to star in Annie Get Your Gun opposite Judy Garland, who had to withdraw from the production due to health reasons. However, the existing Garland footage that was in the can is included on this disc. It's a very special DVD and has many special features, but the Judy Garland footage is the most special of the special features. There's also a Betty Hutton outtake of a song that Irving Berlin wrote specially for the movie. So we heartily recommend it, you get your gun. We also have Lay Girls with Gene Kelly. That was his final musical for MGM until he came back for That's Entertainment. Directed by George Cukor and an Oscar winner for the costumes by the great Ori Kelly. And last but not least, back in print on DVD, a film we just remastered for Blu-ray, and it looks gorgeous in either format. The wonderful Judy Holliday and Dean Martin starring in Vincent Minnelli's Bells Are Ringing from 1960. So all of those are now available on DVD from the Warner Archive Collection. And we now also tip our hats to the great John Waters, as we have two of his favorite films as an entrepreneur, writer, director, producer, and I believe cameraman.
Yeah. And you mentioned there was a time when John Waters was considered a fringe character.
The film that put him on the map truly, after several very interesting littler films, it was Pink Flamingos in 1972 that was unlike anything anyone had ever experienced. And even today, it drops quite a few jaws. And there's a director's commentary on this disc, and we're so glad it's back in print. And we also have to have a moment of memory for the great Divine. This was Divine's true breakthrough performance, as it was for John Waters as well.
Literally unforgettable.
You know, I could talk about this movie for hours, but we don't have hours.
No.
So we'll just talk about the other film from Mr. Waters, Desperate Living from 1977, which is one of the rare John Waters films from this era in which Divine does not appear.
And as a consequence, it's very often overlooked, but it's a terrific John Waters movie.
Desperate Living is the one that always stood out for me because it transported me into alternative Baltimore more, I don't know, completely. It really drew me in because it felt like a film, and then it got inside my head and burst out my skull.
Well, now we're reaching the point in the podcast where we have a chance to hear from you, the avid Warner Archive podcast listener, who can send us missives through the U.S. mail with a letter and a stamp. You can send us a letter, and you can even put in an envelope inside that letter so that Dan can send you some swag in a self-addressed stamped envelope. And today we have several letters to share with you. Matthew, if people want to send us letters, where should they send them?
Please send your missives to Warner Archive Collection, 3400 Riverside Drive, B160-4, Burbank, California, 91522. And what's our special giveaway, Dan?
It's a Dirty Dozen poster while supplies last. Reproduction poster, but it's a reproduction poster from the 70s, so it's a vintage reproduction.
It's an actual MGM International reissue poster featuring the 1967 artwork. So it is not a knockoff. It is created by the production company for release internationally in the early 70s from the original printing plates. And it's a gorgeous poster.
It's an amazing poster, and let's just say that since we started talking about the poster, the letters have been coming in hot and heavy.
Please send me a poster, please. So, I need a poster of Trini Lopez on my wall.
This one is from Jonesville, Louisiana, and it is from James. Gentlemen, I discovered your podcast a few months ago, and I've been hooked ever since. It's always very informative and entertaining. My only complaint is that the podcast is too short.
We laugh only because some people tell us it's too long.
That is actually what brings me to my question. Have the three of you ever recorded a commentary for one of your releases? If not, I think you all should. I've also included a list of 12 movies I would like to see released on Blu-ray. If you still have one of those posters available, by the way, I'd appreciate a copy. 1. The Ballad of Cable Hogue.
Yes. Well, okay, your wish has been fulfilled. Ding.
There you go. And then he goes on to mention another 11. Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, Who's Knocking at My Door, After Hours, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, Captain Blood, Charge of the Light Brigade, Four is a Crowd, Private Lives of Elizabeth and Essex, The Seahawk, They Died with Their Boots On, and Santa Fe Trail. Thanks for everything, James.
Well, he likes Errol Flynn and Peckinpah, and he's got good taste. You gotta say that.
Well, we gave him the first one.
That's right. He got an instant, immediate gratification.
Okay.
And he's going to get a Trini Lopez poster. So
this one is a little bigger in envelope size and comes from Eugene, Oregon. And this is from Rod. He has sealed his envelope. If you want to hear me open your envelope for a long period of time, you should really tape it shut well. Okay, here we go. Dear George, Matt, and DW. Hi, guys. I'm a big fan of Warner Archive and classic Hollywood movies. I recently discovered you from the When Crawford Ruled the Earth episode, as I am a big Joan fan and own many Warner Archive films. Since then, I've listened to many of your back episodes and all the most recents. I must say, you guys are great. I feel as though I am learning so many new things about classic movies in Hollywood. I've already found the podcast invaluable in building my own classic movie collection. One of the things I appreciate most about the Warner Archive is the ability to get some of the most obscure films. I have gathered films by such stars as Kay Francis, William Warren, Norma Shearer, and William Haynes, just to name a few. I was delighted to hear in a recent podcast about the new Lee Tracy films being released, especially Millionaires in Prison. I look forward to seeing that in the future. And this week's discussion of the female-driven pre-code films such as Ladies of the Jury with Edna Mae Oliver are very exciting. Now, if I was to make one request of Warner Archive, it would be a DVD release of Brown of Harvard, the film which made William Haynes a star and also featured the first appearance of John Wayne.
From 1926.
So many other William Haynes films are now available. Why is this only on VHS? I know you guys will have an answer.
Well, it's not on VHS legally. Dun-dun-dun! So, bootleggers beware, we'll come after you. However, Brown of Harvard is not available yet on DVD, but it may become available in the future as we need it to be remastered and need it to be scored. But if you see Brown of Harvard from anybody else, let us know so that we can put them in jail for breaking the law. Seriously, though, copyright infringement is something we take very seriously, and we don't like it when people are making copies of our movies.
And we've talked earlier about one of the problems with silent films is when there is no score.
Right, right. And this was made before there were synchronized scores, and we have to create a new score, and that can be quite expensive. But we have a treasure trove of silent films that we would like to release, and we're hoping to bring one to you in the not-too-distant future.
Well, thank you very much, Rod. And we have one more letter. We're going to go for three. We rarely do this. This one is from Martin in Downey, California. Dear Warner Archive, I'm a big fan of the podcast. You guys have the best job in the world. As a classic film fan, Warner Archive is essential to me, and I wanted to ask a couple of questions. One, will Bad and the Beautiful be released on Blu-ray? Two, will there be more TCM Warner Archive soundtracks in the future? Keep up the good work. Thank you, Martin. P.S. Any Dirty Dozen posters left?
Okay, well, we're sending you a Dirty Dozen poster. We don't have any Blu-rays to talk about in terms of new releases until the next podcast where we'll announce one, so we can't address that issue. But I can address the issue of our soundtracks and the soundtracks that were released many years ago, some of which, or I should say most of which, I had the pleasure to produce and write the liner notes for, or both. There were almost 100 of them. There was a joint venture between Turner, before Warner Brothers bought Turner, and Rhino, and there were wonderful soundtrack albums that we created and released. TCM had their branding on it because before Warner Brothers bought Turner, the idea was that TCM would have their branding on everything, but they didn't have anything actually to do with the making of those soundtracks. The rights, of course, belong to Warner Brothers, as does that library, and the joint venture with Rhino ended in 2011. Since that time, those soundtracks have started to become reissued and available, not only on CD or digitally, but some even on vinyl. Ooh. Can you imagine such a thing? But they are being released in the United States and Canada through Water Tower Music, which is our in-house record company. And the wonderful people at Water Tower Music are using the Warner Archive brand to bring you such soundtracks as Gone with the Wind and Singing in the Rain and many other wonderful albums. And if the question is, what about the albums that never happened, the big musicals that are still awaiting a legitimate expanded soundtrack release, like Till the Clouds Were By or Words and Music. Yes, we still plan to do those, but it will be through Water Tower Music under the Warner Archive umbrella. So you can look forward to more classic soundtracks coming from Water Tower, but we don't have any titles or dates. Just know that it is something that we as a company have a focus on for the future.
They've been really doing a great job over
there. They're doing a terrific job. And to assemble and reconstruct these soundtracks, especially on those films where a lot of elements were missing, is painstaking work. I personally am painfully aware of the chasms, the holes of the important films that we never got to create albums for, definitive albums, the way we did for so many other films. And we've been talking about it and trying to find ways. We have garnered many more of the missing sources and hopefully can present expanded releases of those soundtracks in the not too distant future.
Just a little thing that I've noticed in going to conventions and stuff, I've seen, because soundtracks are still a form of album music. You know, this is an era of singles, right? And this is a format that still belies the album format.
Right. And what's interesting about that is one of the huge sources of revenue for music labels now is streaming music. Mm-hmm. And the soundtrack recordings get streamed as individual songs.
Right.
And in fact, we went to great lengths in making these albums to not only put the music from the movie, but all the supplementary music from the movie and outtakes and demos. And we created 80 minutes of music in many cases. Sometimes we had to go to two CDs. Now all that's being being deconstructed.
Yeah.
Which is very, very frustrating on a personal level, but it's also gratifying if someone is listening to something like Pandora or Spotify or any of the other streaming services that offer music, if they hear a song from one of our films, right, one of our soundtracks, and they're interested in it and they want to learn more about it, they turn on their Shazam and find out what it is, and maybe they'll buy the CD or download the album, and we have plenty more in the archives to uncover. So that is something for music fans. I'm asked about this all the time. It is not something we're abandoning. There are only so many hours in the day, and we're still missing some very key components that would make complete albums for certain films.
He just lists his top five pre-code films. I thought this was kind of a fun list. Number one, Madam Satan. Number two, Redheaded Woman. Number three, Babyface. Four, 42nd Street. And five, Mandalay.
Now, talk about good taste.
That's excellent taste. I would put Babyface at the top and 42nd Street right below it, but those are five great films.
I would go for 42nd Street just because I like the alliteration, I guess, or enumeration.
But in any case, that's all we have time for this week's Warner Archive Collection podcast. But fear not, we'll be back soon, very, very soon, with another new podcast. But until that time, I am George Feltenstein.
I'm Matt Patterson.
I'm Skip Remming.
Thanks for listening to this week's Warner Archive podcast.